Well, it's not a... No, well, I mean, people come out and sort of said, oh, I found that funny. I said, well, that's a bit odd. And they said, well, I found that very funny. And some people said, well, I found that utterly devastating. And I said, oh, no, I found that sort of blacky comic.
That's what I mean, the tonal thing.
Yeah, I don't know how you play it.
Well, when we were working on it, what struck me most was I think he liked the tenderness that I brought to the character, that it wasn't a banker, you know, that there was a sort of tenderness. And I think that there's that element of someone coming... I mean, I don't know, because he would never answer that sort of question, but my own interpretation of it was this was an entirely practical arrangement.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Coming up, we're at the Cannes Film Festival for a special interview with the renowned actor Toby Jones.
People talk about the coolness of the films and very un-Hollywood-style treatment of emotion, particularly in this script where you have a story being told in lots of different registers. You've got to be engaged in life in a very un-austere way. You've got to be totally interested in lots of different kinds of people and lots of different ways of thinking.
From political dramas W and Frost Nixon to Harry Potter and Captain America, we'll discover the secret to his adaptability and how he wound up in one of this year's standout films at Cannes, Michael Haneke's Happy End. And a little later...
The lady'll have a Bacardi on the rocks.
For the gentleman, vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
Touché.
James Bond star Roger Moore passes away at the age of 89. We'll get a refresher course in why he'll go down as one of the screen's greatest action heroes. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. On paper, the Russian film Loveless might not sound like the kind of inspiring fare that might get the Cannes Film Festival crowd rubbing their hands with anticipation. But as the filmmakers told reporters at the debut screening this week, the film had to be made without the support of the Russian government. The reason? Well, as Variety pointed out, the plot revolves around a man whose house is confiscated by a corrupt official. It's not too difficult to draw parallels between the dark, bleak world of Loveless and the dark, bleak political reality of Russia. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Despite being the 70th edition of the world's most celebrated film festival, this year's Cannes has left many critics feeling a little vacant. After the initial tensions between Netflix and the jury president Pedro Almodovar, which we discussed on last week's show, there hasn't been an awful lot to keep those waiting in line at the festival talking. As Manola Dargis wrote for the New York Times, many attendees felt a degree of unease. Security has been very tight this year and, of course, for good reason. The organisers of this event and the city of Cannes spare no expense to keep the festival safe. But there's no escaping the sense that the streets are a little emptier than usual. But this is the movie business and, well, the show must go on. In a moment, we'll catch up with the actor, Toby Jones, with an interview recorded by Monocle's man in Cannes this year, Jason Solomons. But first, Jason shares a few thoughts with Monocle's Tom Edwards on why Loveless is this year's standout film.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is not a spectacular year, but it's a very solid year. I think the competition films have been a bit conservative in their taste. Nothing has grabbed you as it's kind of debuted. No one has come from left field, like a first-timer, for example. Like a few years ago, we had Son of Saul by Laszlo Nemes, and there was a big shock, you know, when that happened. But that hasn't happened this year. So as we edge towards Palme d'Or, I'm very much thinking that this is the year that Andrei Zviagonitsev establishes himself at the top table of world filmmakers. Now, that it's not the best headline in the world, I know, for people who kind of want to splash on such stories. But he has for a long time been a great filmmaker from Russia. He won at Venice with The Return about 10 years ago. And he's been building a very solid body of work ever since The Banishment, Elena, which was a very popular in Berlin, and recently in Cannes with a brilliant film called Leviathan, which didn't win the Palme d'Or, but got a lot of props. And for me, is one of the great films of the 21st century so far. And he's there with a new film called Loveless, which is about a bitter divorce between a husband and wife who then have to kind of work together to find their missing 12-year-old son who sort of disappears down the cracks of this relationship. Now, it's a brilliantly savage, bitter portrait of sort of the Soviet, post-Soviet era Russia, where we are now. It's probably not the sort of film that Putin would want you to see, but it's kind of always been about that. I mean, it's probably a metaphor for Putin's Russia, for Ukraine, for all sorts of things, capitalism, consumerism. I thought it was very brilliant, bleak and mysterious, but brilliant. And about the unease that we're all feeling at the moment. So for me, that's the one that's leading the pack. And I think it would be a very, very worthy Palme d'Or winner for a very excellent director.
What about some individual acting honours? Dustin Hoffman, another sort of noteworthy, just in a few seconds, tell us what he's been up to.
Be a nice surprise. He plays this kind of grumpy paterfamilias of a New York family in the Meyerowitz stories from Noah Baumbach. I thought he was very funny. It's great to see Dustin Hoffman always. Sometimes he's better than he's great in this one. He's right back, and I think, you know, a nice little nod at Cannes could see him all the way through to the Oscars next year in a supporting actor nomination.
Sofia Coppola, she's adapted The Beguiled, which some people may remember from the early 70s. Does this deliver, Jason?
Yeah, it's a very good, solid studio movie. Nicole Kidman and Kirsten Dunst and Colin Farrell as a wounded soldier kind of amongst them. She twitches it around that Don Siegel movie with Clint Eastwood, where he was the kind of sort of sexy person in the room. And this way, it's kind of the women kind of are on top of Colin Farrell. I mean, not literally, but sort of around him. She does it very well, Sofia Coppola. I don't think it's a winner in anything, but it's a very good and woozy-looking studio movie that was a nice difference in Canada this year. But I think if you're going to look for a sort of female breakout role, there's a Russian actress called, whose name is very hard to pronounce, but she's going to talk called A Gentle Creature. So I think she might be the best actress. They always pick a strange one.
Quel âge as-tu?
13 ans.
Je te croyais plus jeune.
Elle va avoir 13 ans dans 2 mois, c'est ça?
Well, as you might have guessed, the scene here is a slightly tense dinner gathering in Michael Haneke's new film, Happy End. As anyone familiar with the director will probably guess, it's a deliberate misnomer. The two-time Palme d'Or winning director returned to Cannes this year with the dark tale of a series of seemingly distant people. For a while, it might seem like a series of ordinary events. Then comes the realization that Haneke might actually be daring you to assume, because if you do, you'll never suspect what's really happening. Jason Solomon's caught up with one of the film's stars, Toby Jones, on the sunny Cannes waterfront.
There are certain directors you think, well, of course I'd love to work with them, but it's not very likely. And then my agent rang up and said, a director called Michael Haneke. Yes. Yeah. Although I couldn't really believe it, and there was with some nerves that I then went to meet him. And then you realise that he doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything without, like, the more preparation than anyone I've ever met.
Mm.
So he'd seen pretty much every film I've ever done.
Right.
And he knew that I was the guy he wanted, like that.
Wow.
Which is...
Had he seen Dad's Army?
But I'm not sure if he'd seen Dad's Army. I didn't ask him specifically on Dad's Army. But it was extraordinary. Not many people make me nervous anymore, but I was nervous to meet him because I'm a big fan.
Yeah,
you think, well, I hope I don't screw this up.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it is about the directors because you think, well, like, you know, you just want to be in that company. And because you've got Jean-Louis Trintignant and Isabelle Huppert as well. Yeah. And, you know, I think most people, because you're and Toby Jones.
Yeah.
It's almost like a sort of little, almost like a joke at the end. And Toby Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, with the utmost respect, as you know. But it did seem a sort of left field kind of character. And I suppose that he is one. I mean, that a surprising casting results in a sort of surprise character.
Yes. I mean, I haven't seen the film yet, but I know that tonally... There's so much to say about Haneke, but one of the key things that strikes me about his cinema is that he's very interested in modulating tone. When I read the script, I went, this is an extraordinary script. It's not straightforward what's being said. There's no, as usual, there's no judgment. There's no assessment. The judgment's for the audience.
There's no hope. There's no help. There's no hope.
No. And like I say, I could only feel like, well, it's deliberate what he asked me to do. I haven't seen the film, but I don't know if it's meant to be comic. I certainly didn't feel I was meant to be a comic character.
Well, it's not a... I mean, people come out and sort of said, oh, I found that funny. I said, well, that's a bit odd. And they said, well, I found that very funny. And some people said, well, I found that utterly devastating. And I said, oh, no, I found that sort of blackly comic.
That's what I mean, the tonal thing.
Yeah, so. I don't know how you play it.
Well, when we were working on it, what struck me most was I think he liked the tenderness that I brought to the character, that it wasn't a banker, you know, that there was a sort of turn. And I think that there's that element of someone coming... I mean, I don't know, because he would never answer that sort of question, but my own interpretation of it was this was an entirely practical arrangement. And he takes the time to show that my character is as lonely as everyone else, is as detached as everyone, and he bothers to put that in. And I thought that was very interesting, the idea.
Tell us, I mean, for those who haven't seen it, describe your character and what he is, because he does come from a strange place. You sort of have an affair with Isabel Huppert's character, but you're a business interest.
Yes, and there's a hint of corruption, and there's a hint of... The whole film is reeks of decadence, but, I mean, there's a sense of corruption, but also isolation, that, you know, there's a relationship going on, but how possible is it for people who are in this world to have relationships? How possible is it for people to declare affection?
Your insurance game that you're
guys in? I'm trying to sort of sort out this, so we can do the takeover.
Yeah.
There's a sort of, how can we get around this terrible accident that's happened?
Yes. You think you're nice, because you're played by Toby Jones, but there's a certain venality about your character kind of sleeping with her and also...
But that's the idea. I think that's always his idea, is that you're not allowed to settle into anything. Someone asked at the press conference this morning, said, tell us about the Calais migrants, as if he was going to say some big point about immigration. I think his point is, it's happening. This is happening in the corner of our eye all the time. This stuff, you know, we are like that all the time. Everything is mediated by these noise all the time. And I think that's his point as much as anything else.
Well, when you say the corner of the screen, you're absolutely right. I mean, he's the classic corner of the screen. Well, I put it in there, you just didn't see it because I was doing some prestidigitation over the corner there and I distracted you.
I can't tell you how precise every single frame is. That I have no doubt, because talking to my colleagues this morning, I said, how is the film? They said, it's what we read in the script. It's exactly right. Because there's no coverage, there's no... reaction shots.
No.
It's like, we shot that bit, and that's that bit of the story, and that's why we shoot it 28 times, because there's going to be no cutaways. 28 takes on one little three-line exchange I did, and then there was one where 12 of us were in a scene, and we did 49 takes of that.
Is that the party scene? The engagement scene, Right. I mean, because it's so long and detached, you kind of think it's all done in one kind of... So presumably he goes from the top each time.
Yes, you do the whole thing all the time. Because there's nothing to cut to. That's why he has to get it right. It's real tightrope walking cinema, because when he goes to the edit suite, he's got what he's got. So he has to get it.
Yeah. You know? Well, see, like, I mean, I've met him, and he's one of those people that you always think, oh, they're going to be very scary. But he's actually very warm and mentorish and kind of avuncular in a way.
Well, I think when one looks at, you know, people talk about the coolness of the films and, you know, the kind of long shot thing and the very un-Hollywood style treatment of emotion, like virtually no close-up or whatever. But if you read those scripts, I think of people like Chekhov, you know, where, particularly in this script, where you have a story being told in lots of different registers and lots of different, from lots of different points of view. And in order to write something like that, you've got to be engaged in life in a very unaustere way. You've got to be totally interested in lots of different kinds of people and lots of different ways of thinking.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I've seen the film, and it's sort of haunting me still. I almost can't react to it immediately. I think with the last film, Amour, you know, there was death and there was sadness, and you could sort of come out having cried. This one,
it's cool,
it doesn't afford you any of those kind of easy sentiments. So if crying over death is easy, it doesn't give you anything. So it's kind of.
Well, I said to him when we first chatted about it, I said, I'm intrigued by this big hole at the beginning of the script. This is presumably, you know, I wouldn't say that's what the film's about. To a certain extent, I think that was what I took from the whole script, that there's a big fucking hole that people are falling into.
Yeah, yes. We probably thought you got the job, but I know you got the job, but you kind of nailed it.
No, he went, oh, that's interesting, which is what he says to everything.
There's a scene on a beach with an ice cream seller, you weren't involved in it, where there's a sort of chat about having a Magnum or a Cornetto or a Badoit or an Evian. I think even those brand names are are particularly kind of
nothing's
precision tool.
Nothing's accidental. There were a couple of times he gave me huge compliments, and I tried to understand when he told me why he was complimenting me. I was trying to work out, what is it about that? And so at the wedding, the announcement of the engagement, and the immigrants had come in, you went to take off one of their backpacks, and he said, this is genius. How many actors would think of that? And I was going, yeah, okay. He just said, it's politeness gone crazy. It's kind of, you know, this crazy juxtaposition.
Right.
And stuff. But, you know...
I'm not sure that's in.
It may not be in, but he loved it.
It's funny, you're quite quiet in the film. I don't know if that was you kind of going, well, he doesn't talk very loud, my character, or they just turn the
sound
down. But yeah, I mean, not like he can't hear you, but it's, you know, it's quite a sort of reined in performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Having come, we mentioned Dad's Army sort of flippantly, but having come off a sort of a big comedy like that, as an actor, do you think, oh God, this is challenging me to a new level of performance? We know you for your physicality quite often.
Yeah.
Did this one kind of, do you think, well, like, because it's Hannah, I'm going to bring something else?
I mean, Dad's Army is absolutely fantastic to do because you have to think very fast, very physically. You're sort of inventing a lot of stuff on the spot. There's a lot to do in your days. And here you're making a film in a very different rhythm and you're listening all the time to what he's saying. And what he's usually saying is, don't take responsibility for the story. That's how I took what he was saying. Mm. Just don't take responsibility for the story. And as actors, we're sort of hardwired to do that. We're hardwired, however much we think we're not doing that, we are playing just our character, going from A to B to C. They're, because of our background in theatre or whatever, they're just a part of you that's sort of going, will they understand? And he's just, he's absolutely laser-like on that. Don't take responsibility.
Tell me about Huppert as well. I mean, there's Annika as well, obviously, and you think, but also working with Isabelle Huppert, that ain't bad.
Well, like all the greatest actors I've got to work with, you know, what's inspiring and what's really fascinating is just this unquenchable kind of curiosity and desire to get it right, and this is it, I fucked up, this is it. Oh, you know, and it's reassuring because that's how I feel most of the time. This is it, this is the last one, this is the last gig.
Never work again.
Yeah, and she knows she's held in high esteem. It's not that, it's more a huge hunger to do the best she possibly can.
Well, it's work. I mean, she's out of bed, she's got, you know, turned up to work.
Yeah.
That's work,
yeah.
Right?
You know, she's not being Isabelle Huppert 24 hours a day. She's doing the job, you know.
Mm, mm. The sort of tenor of the piece and the fact that you're in it and part of an ensemble. And this is quite an ensemble for him, I would say. Considering Amour was so tight recently. And I suppose The White Ribbon was an ensemble as well. Does he work on the sort of normal scenes? Or does everyone got to be there for the 6 weeks of the shoot?
I know that on a big ensemble scenes, like when we're at the concert and things like that, we would all obviously be there. But even then, because he's only using bits of that and he knows what he's using, you wouldn't need to be there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was very, very nervous about that cello scene. He said, once you get this over, I'll be fine. And I said, what is it about this that's really bothering you? And he said, it's just like a big set piece scene where there's lots going on. And I'm going, well, you know, in British TV, they just crank that out. You just crank it out. Which is inspiring. I mean, it's inspiring to be around someone like that.
Well, I'm very delighted for you that that can be the case. Very different from when you were last here in Cannes, which was with the Tale of Tales, when you were falling in love with a flea.
Falling in love with Isabelle Huppert.
Yes.
It's progress.
Yes.
It's progress. It's progress.
Soon you'll be kissing Kate Moss or something. Working for Matteo Garrone there, which is an Italian film. Brilliant as well in his own way. But, I mean, you couldn't get two more different characters, I wouldn't imagine. It's precision, isn't it, when they get a hold of you?
I think as well, he's a more Latin director than Michael. You know, he's totally emotional, totally visceral, and, you know, wants to laugh and, you know, grabs you and says, that's great. And, so, and it's not quite the same with Michael. It's a bit more... It's just you're very aware. I think everyone on the crew, everyone in the cast is very aware. This is one guy's obsession to get this film right. And you're everyone in the room, everyone in the production, everyone is making that possible.
Yeah, and Isabelle is a sort of veteran of
my... But you wouldn't even know that.
Right.
I don't think you'd even know that. I remember you'd see him talking to her and you'd just go, have these people met? Because he's so relentless. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think she's... It's not that she wants to be told off, but I think she doesn't want to be told it's good if it's not good.
Yeah. I wouldn't dare tell her. It was if it wouldn't lie to her for a million years.
Exactly.
The kind of career now, and now you've got a Hanukkah on your CV. Yeah. What are you up to next? Is it one of those very strange acting things where you're off to do something completely different?
Yeah, it is slightly. I finished a French film this week, kind of populist French comedy where I'm playing that photographer. I'm not playing Spencer Turnick, but I'm playing a version of him. And he goes to a French village that is really struggling with unemployment stuff, and he proposes to do that. I finished that this week, but I've been filming that with Jurassic World 3, so the two things are kind of nicely balanced.
And you're in Jurassic World 3?
Jurassic World 2.
I'm sure there'll
be a 3. Classic era. That's just one of those jobs that takes months and months and months. Yeah. You check in every now and then, you go, what was this again? You know, where were we in this scene?
Wow, so you're working green screens and dinosaurs and...
Yes, doing that. And then I'm going, which will be great, in about 3 weeks' time I'll start Detectorists, which is this sitcom I do with Mackenzie about metal detectors, we just go to Suffolk for 6 weeks and do that.
And you can do that. You can say, well, I'm doing the Hollywood blockbuster, I'm doing Cannes Film Festival, and then I'm off with Mackenzie.
It's not that I say I can do it. I mean, people think I can. I don't think I can do any of it. It's literally like you feel, you know, Jason, in your world, like in my world, it's a huge privilege to do what I do. You know, I'm very aware of the privilege that it is. You know, it's not that I take it lightly, but it's just fantastic to have that contract. Mm. That's the only MO.
And what about all this? Cannes? I know we met on a boat in Venice, and here we are, full circle, on a jetty. And
you love all this. I've heard you. I know you love it.
I get all excited.
I find it gets harder and harder, all of this. Like tonight, I find that all intimidating, to be honest. And I used to, before I knew about it, I used to think, oh, that's be great.
That's sort of what it's all about.
That'd be great. And it isn't. I find it. It's sort of the opposite of what I'm doing. I'm trying to disappear all the time.
But then don't you play a part when you're going up that red carpet? You know what I mean, in a way? I mean, Isabel's brilliant at it. She's done 100 times.
Yes. I feel oddly out of place. When you and I were listening to New Wave Records in the 1980s, neither of us wanted to be on a red carpet. And there's a part of me that's sitting on my shoulder going, what a wanker, you idiot. What the fuck are you doing?
And you've got to go up those steps and wave.
You know, and it's just this, people that I've admired in my life, the huge majority of them will never stand on a red carpet.
And yet, you know, Hanukkah does it and Huppert does it. They know the value of it.
It's marketing.
Mm. And, you know, it's Cannes.
Yes.
There's his 70 years of history as well.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
You know, even Orson Welles managed to do it.
Yeah, I don't do it down. I'm just saying that my personal response to it is that I find it all so much noise.
Yeah, and I do think, as an actor, especially one like you, sort of chameleonic to the extreme, really. You've even just enumerated four projects there. Yeah. You are a very physical kind of protean kind of being. Yeah. To then kind of have yourself kind of nailed to an image that might be then, oh, he's the guy in the black tie up the red carpet.
Yes, and who the fuck is that guy anyway?
Exactly.
And who cares about all of that?
Yeah.
And really, who cares about me? I'm not there modelling or anything.
No,
a lot of people are busy modelling.
Will you wear some clothes, though?
I hope to wear clothes tonight. But of course, anything's possible.
That's the best we can expect. A clothed Toby Jones.
And he's the best you can expect.
The actor Toby Jones speaking to Jason Solomons in Cannes. Still to come, we will sit down for an intensive lesson on why Roger Moore really was one of the all-time greats of the action genre. Stay tuned. The Cannes takeover continues at MUBI this week with the 2009 Israeli film Eyes Wide Open. It played as part of the official selection and looks at tradition and guilt through a small, heartbreaking lens within a traditional Jewish community. And if you couldn't quite make it to the festival this year, you can continue your at-home mini-fest with the genre-defying 2013 Italian film Salvo, a refreshing overhaul of the Hitman story. Plus, if that wasn't quite enough, there's also the 2012 Egyptian melodrama After the Battle, which takes an emotionally driven look at the lives of people whose stories are woven with the events of mid-revolution turmoil. Jet off to Cannes from the comfort of your couch with a whole month of movies for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. When someone becomes famous for playing just one particular role, their legacy tends to fall into a fairly predictable category. Perhaps no film franchise has provided fodder for more critical listicles and think pieces than James Bond. So when news broke this week that Roger Moore had passed away, the floodgates were open. But to compare Mr. Moore is to miss the genius that was his gift to movie lovers anywhere. He wasn't interested in becoming a legend or making it among Hollywood's greatest. He just wanted to give us all a good reason to go to the movies. So pour yourself a drink as we remember Roger Moore.
Yes, sir? The lady will have a Bacardi on the rocks.
For the gentleman, vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
Touché.
Sly, suave, and dripping with sarcasm, Roger Moore played his James Bond in a chord that was quite unlike the many gentlemen that would follow him. Contrasting the rugged masculinity of Sean Connery's earlier outing, Moore's Bond was a seasoned playboy who would strut into any situation imaginable, armed with confidence bordering on cockiness, and a Rolex Submariner complete with buzzsaw. Contrary to popular belief, Moore actually wasn't Sir Ian Fleming's first choice. He'd actually only just started starring in the hit television series The Saint when the first Bond movie, Dr. No, premiered in theatres, introducing audiences to Sean Connery as
Bond. James Bond.
There are conflicting accounts of when exactly Moore was first considered for the role of the world's most famous spy. But what's certainly true is that he was not among the A-list names on Fleming's initial wish list. And by his own admission, Moore hadn't considered himself a contender for the role. It was only after Connery declared in 1966 that he would never again star in the role that made him famous that Moore began seriously considering himself as a potential heir to the shaken martini. Although he still had to wait for George Lazenby's brief outing to falter, and for Connery's brief return before he finally made his debut in 1973's Live and Let Die. Writing for the New York Times, Roger Greenspun reviewed the film with a decidedly ho-hum tone.
There are now 8 Bond movies, and though they are the work of many different talents, they do represent a recognisable tradition in which the whole, or the memory of the whole, seems to be greater than the sum of the parts. The plots tend to flow into each other, one scheme after another for controlling all the money in the world.
Moore's Bond films could never be mistaken for quality cinema. But that's also a key part of their charm, from his perfectly placed fake nipple that allows him to impersonate an assassin in The Man with the Golden Gun, to his Lotus Esprit Coupe that conveniently transforms itself into a submarine in The Spy Who Loved Me, Moore's Bond was never afraid of venturing into the absurd.
All those stunts, there's a fantastic stunt at the beginning of the movie. Skiing, that's you. Well, of course it is. All over Siberia on one ski. And what about hanging off the Golden Gate Bridge? That you? Well, of course it is. What you see, you believe, don't you?
Yeah.
Right, you believe it. You'll believe anything.
Nobody does it better.
Compared to Daniel Craig's brooding, soul-searching spy, the Bond of Roger Moore's era might seem a little silly. But in an age of Nixon's America and Thatcher's Britain, audiences relied on 007 to stay cool and impeccably groomed, no matter how serious this ever-changing world in which we live in might become. And at that, well, nobody did it better. That's it for today's program. Thanks to our editor, Kieran Matthew Banerjee, and our researcher, Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show, it's back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. We'll catch you then. Keeping all my secrets.